Hello.
I think I hear you. Do you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear.
Fantastic. Thank you for coming on.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm glad you're able to work something out with our differing time zones.
No kidding. That's the amazing thing about this internet stuff is the fact that you, as long as people are willing to want to communicate, there usually a if there's a will, there's a way to make it happen.
Definitely.
So let me start by being a creeper,
Okay.
which is always a fantastic way to start. One of the things
You're
that
the one hanging out in the back row, aren't you?
I am always that one. Just don't mind me, and the guy with the silly, pajamas. So here's the thing. One of the things that worried me as we were trying to schedule this interview is the fact that you said you asked another person in a different podcast that you were looking through their Instagram feed and that you recalled something from their life and you brought it up on the show. And so I just want to be prepared the way that I read it from yours. I just want to be prepared, for anything. And I'm like, oh no, she's going to think I'm one of these gotcha journalists that wants to capture you and, and corner you and get you to say something that I want to say. And so I'm hoping that that's not how I'm coming off, but yeah, but.
Oh no. I was just worried that you're just gonna, back in 2017, you posted this very specific article, and I just want more information about it. And I just want to make sure that to give out the most amount of information possible. Yeah.
Okay, well, good.
Just my over analytical self.
Well, okay. Well, I'm over anxious, so I guess we are the perfect storm of weirdos. So, but on that tone, let me begin with my first question. And again, I told you that this was all very conversational, and this is kind of how it goes. On that point, one of the things that has been going on online today, and I've been posting about it, and I've been seeing a lot of people post, is the concept of the digital trail that we leave behind. And looking at the various places where you're online, I understand that you're on YouTube, you have your own webpage, you're obviously on Twitter. You have left a digital print, correct? And so in this space, and again, I'm going to be presumptuous here, but I'm going to say that you're many years my junior, unfortunately, that you are a generation that is now having to deal with truly having a digital fingerprint that will follow you forever and having to reckon with that years later when perhaps you get to where I am to, now. So I guess my question to you is, and especially in the environment and in the atmosphere in your chosen profession, what are some of the things that you look out for? Or what if you were talking to another person that was your age, like how would you say is how do you navigate in this space, and what's your plans for the future? 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 15 years from now.
Oh my gosh, that is like the
But no
most
gun,
horrible
but.
question to ask the millennials. What are you doing in 5 years? We'll see. I think definitely a huge digital footprint, and that's kind of where all or a good majority of the marketing to who you are and what your brand is really is where that really shines. How much of us really watch TV? So is getting a TV show really worth it nowadays when not many of us watch TV? Like, yeah, we have access to Netflix and all these other things, but having a larger Instagram following is probably going to amp up your career more than a TV show will in today's day and age. So, yeah, it's kind of funny, and I'm sure you experienced this too, where on Facebook it will repost your memories from,
Sure.
what you posted 8, 9, 10 years ago. And, there are just some hilarious posts that I come across because it's like Alicia Fisher, and then I just post is eating a really delicious meal because that's just how social media worked in that day, and that's kind of what we posted about. So it's kind of funny to see it all coming up. And I was actually talking about this with my partner about, kids having or like brand new babies having Instagram pages before they, I guess, even consent to it. If you look at Lights, she's a Canadian artist. Her daughter Rocket has her own Instagram page, and so it's going to be super interesting in about 10 years or so to see what the generation who never really consented to having all of their images being posted on social media, for them to look back and see what they think about an entire Instagram page being dedicated to them and their life story. So you definitely have to be cognizant about what you're posting and what you're talking about. But it also has to be on brand, right? And making sure that you're promoting the message that you want to get out there and promote. And, you know, everyone in the sexuality educator field, in whatever capacity that may be, we really have to be critical about what we post, not only to make sure it's inclusive and LGBTQ friendly and all that jazz, but then there's also, you know, are you going to get shadow banned? Is your account going to be shut down? I know that Instagram and Facebook accounts are being shut down left, right, and center. So even people that are posting about queer relationships and just using that word queer has been starting to get flagged more on YouTube and Instagram. I know Eva, what are you doing, just posted about like lesbian sex, and it wasn't even like about sex. It was just about how lesbians, you know, hook up and what they do. And, you know, that was taken down, and she has a lot of posts that are kind of being taken down. So there's the censorship on sexuality education and that whole realm of things. So yeah, I think in 10 years it will definitely have a lot more studies about the impacts of that social media footprint that you may or may not have even asked for.
Yeah, to a certain degree, I find that what you do is liberating. I think if you were investing in the future, I think that as a society that we are going to be much more open 10 years from now than we are today. I think this juggernaut that is the internet, you can't stop it from the standpoint of what people have access to when they're available. And that means that there's a more open society. With that being said, you live in times like this when we're still dealing with the technological adolescence of our time. And so it's interesting to me, you know, there's a lot of complaints about millennials from people my age and older who talk about, well, what do these kids know? And the fact is that we don't know, but the ones that are going to have to navigate and make up the rules for this and to a certain degree eventually legislate this will be your generation. And I find that fascinating.
Yeah, definitely. It will be a lot of technological shifts. And even in our world of sexuality, we're seeing a huge boost in the techno-sexuality field of how technology is being integrated into our intimate connections and our romantic lives. We're seeing sex robots, and there's no such thing as an actual sex robot at this point. They're barely being able to program these things how to walk, let alone have sex. So, you know, these more sex dolls. We're seeing parlors, if you will, where you can go into these places and pick the doll that you want to have sex with. We're seeing a more of a push in medication to be able to enhance our connection. Now, do I think that those are a band-aid fix? Yes, and there's a lot more to it. But yeah, in the techno-sexuality field is definitely, in the virtual reality field, is going to be really booming, if not already has been booming.
Well, in my time, they said that one day that we were going to have hovercrafts, and I don't have one yet. So yeah. I'm a little upset that we don't, and so I'm not holding my breath for any kind of sex robots in the next 10 years.
They must have got lost in the mail or something like that, or hovercrafts. They're on the way.
I hope so, from your mouth to whoever's listening here. So let's backtrack a little bit, and I wanted for you to take me through. I have never heard of a master's on erotic imagery. And my understanding from listening to one of your YouTube channels, which, by the way, it's a shame that you only have 9 videos. You definitely have a very charismatic approach to how you're deliverer and obviously an extremely good looking young lady. So I think that you definitely should invest more time in the YouTube. But that's a story for a different day. In one of your videos, you talked about that as a field of study. What I want to know is, what the heck is it, and how does somebody start on the path to want to make that a field of research?
Yeah, well, technically, I studied erotic imagery while studying something totally different. So in this field of sexuality and even therapy to some extent, you kind of have to pave your way in terms of what you want to study. So my degree was in a research specialist in psychology, minors in women's and gender studies and anthropology. So there I studied, you know, human connection through more social psychology. And then fast forwarding after my victimology certificate, I got a master's in cultural analysis and social theory. So there I studied erotic imagery and ultimately the online consumption trends of erotic imagery and equating some theory and some social theory into that, to the dismay of my cohort who were studying farming and art, and then I come in and want to study porn. So yeah, there was a definitely, but there, you know, porn is such a fascinating cultural phenomenon that we don't talk about, and so that's why it's super interesting to me. So cultural analysis and social theory technically is my very boring master's, but yeah, I studied erotic imagery in it.
Now, what does that entail? I mean, and we talked about porn, but I do want to break it down. Was it something where you were looking at magazine spreads, pun intended? Were you looking at video? Were you looking, you know, because as far as I know, even as far back as the Romans, it's interesting. I was at one of our museums here in town, because we have those here in America still. And in this museum, they had like a vase which showed basically a bath in Roman times. And it was very graphic, well, graphic for them. Male on male sexuality going on, and it's part of antiquity, and we put it in museums, but to me that's some degree of eroticism that has been in our walls or in our furniture or in our, you know, glassware for a very long time. So when you're talking about imagery, what does that encompass, or how did you break it down through your study?
Yeah, so Michel Foucault kind of talks about what you're talking about in terms of seeing, you know, older man on younger man and these very erotic poses, and how, you know, we like to think we're so sexually liberated, but back then there'd be a husband and a wife, and the husband would be hooking up with the little boy next door kind of thing. So for me specifically, I actually studied online erotic imagery, and more specifically Pornhub, actually. And I do get a lot of flack for that, because people go, oh, Pornhub, it's the bane of, you know, all porn, it's absolutely terrible, you should never watch it. But what we're seeing is a continuous increase in the access to Pornhub and the erotic imagery on there. And the last state status that we had with that is that 100 million people per day were going onto that website. So people are accessing it, and specifically in the United States, at a very, very high rate. So specifically, I studied online and Pornhub.
Now, is the blowback coming from the standpoint of, is from the economic standpoint, that that Pornhub is not, well, it's a purveyor of the content, but it's the funds are not going to the content creators?
Exactly. Yeah. So if you're not paying for your porn, essentially you're stealing it. It's kind of like the movies, right? If you're not paying for movies, if you're not paying for your music, then you're stealing it from the artist. So it's the same thing with porn. And it's we don't necessarily think about it that way, because it's so anonymous and accessible that you can just click away and it's all right there. And a lot of creators and producers are starting to, and performers too, are starting to really jump on Pornhub and to start getting their content taken down. I know Buck Angel has reported a lot of their videos that have been posted on there, because essentially it's all stolen. So there is that pushback, and exactly what you said, if you're not paying for it, then technically you're stealing it. But we all pretty much have, I won't say all, but a lot of this generation with the access to internet, there's always been free porn. You know, ever since the golden era of pornography ended in the early 1980s, you know, free access to pornography with the introduction of porn being on VHSs started to be distributed widely and more privately. So, yeah.
VHS cassettes. See, that's me showing.
I know
my
what
age.
Those are, believe.
I'm sure that you do. Okay, well, let's pivot on Pornhub for a second, and I'll ask your opinion on this because it's something that I had read on the internet, so it must be true. Something to the effect of the effect that pornography, never mind the ethics of paying for your porn, which I think we are in agreement on that it's a form of stealing and it's an issue. But the content is there and it's accessible to anybody that chooses to log on to it, who's an adult that can. But one of the things that I had read was the concept of young men having basically unfettered access to pornography, in that through this, they're, and I'm paraphrasing this really badly, so I apologize for that, but the concept of the fact that this is affecting how their interactions with real life women, never mind robots, and also that it's affecting the way that they are able to gain an erection, the way that sometimes they could lose an erection, because the amount of stimulus that is available a la carte on a Pornhub isn't necessarily what's available in a real life scenario. I don't know, in your studies, have you looked into anything like that? Do you have any feedback on something along those lines?
Yeah, definitely. So a lot of my presentations don't necessarily talk about is porn good or bad, but I actually talk more about porn literacy. But to go off what you're saying, it's very interesting the way the scientific world works. And this is why I actually operate through a variety of frameworks. So yeah, one of them being academia and science. I have my degree in that, but I also incorporate theory, lived experience, clinical work, and also education to gain a more well-rounded understanding of the world around us, because academia can only show us so much information, and the way things are skewed nowadays can really harm the perceptions of the reader. And I did a lot of work with this in my undergrad, where we took Cosmo articles and then went back to the original research. And one of the ones that was so funny was that it was like, oh, bald men are sexy, and if you're thinking about shaving your head, you need to, because women find bald men more sexier. And so I went back to the original research, and what they found actually is that yes, people thought that bald men, women in particular, were more dominant, but in terms of sexiness, that actually slightly decreased. So the Cosmo article just equated dominance with sexiness, but even though the research showed otherwise. In my presentation, some of them I have a question of how much porn depicts violence against women. And I have the answers 2%, 26%, 38%, and 98%. And scientifically speaking, they are all correct, because it all comes down to how you define violence against women. And the ones that have the higher ones would put threesomes as violence against women, would put very loud orgasms as violence against women. And we're not even going to even think about BDSM, kink, fetish. That's all violence against women, according to this research. So Taylor Cohot, he's based out of Western University. I think he's going somewhere else. He's actually done a lot of research with porn. And it's super fascinating because, one of the things I hear is like, oh, if you watch porn, you end up hating women. And what Taylor Cohut actually found was that pornography users held more egalitarian attitudes towards women in positions of power, towards women working outside the home, and towards abortion, and actually didn't really differ between non-users of pornography and users of pornography in terms of traditional family values and their self-identification as a feminist. And what they found in the study too is that the men who watched porn actually believed in the rights to abortion and identifying as a feminist users who watched porn. So that was a kind of a fun thing that interesting. And Taylor also did some research about, can porn negatively impact your life? And what Taylor found was that from all the couples that had been in a relationship for longer, I think it was 6 months. Anyway, it was more of like getting to the longer side of the relationship. 6 months isn't that long, but from all the samples that they found, that they researched, no negative effects was the most commonly impact of impact reported of pornography use. So couples actually don't really find that much negative impacts, and then positive impacts was the second most common response, and then negatively perceived impacts were reported a lot less frequently. So while porn in research is super interesting, and Taylor Cohart has a lot of really interesting research on religious individuals and how they're watching porn. And I don't necessarily have that stat because I don't necessarily talk about religious impacts in terms of what I talk about internationally. But what Taylor also found is that participants who shared pornography use with their partners actually reported more open sexual communication and greater closeness compared to couples that didn't talk about porn within their relationships. So to kind of go back,
No. Just real quick, you know, does that depend on region? Meaning, would a Canada or a a European couple be more open to kind of having that dialogue versus a U.S. couple, so considering the fact that we tend to, here in America, to be a little bit more puritanical?
Yeah, I think Taylor did this research. I think it was in Canada and then Croatia, where he gathered the two samples. So that's what I would know from there. But I would highly recommend reaching out to Taylor because he's done so much incredible research. But where I really take my presentations is actually talking about the notion of porn literacy, and should we really be talking about it? And there's been some research that has come out this year talking about the importance of talking about porn literacy and why it's so important, because when we talk about porn literacy and reflect on how it impacts us, what they actually are finding is that talking about it reduces the shame regarding pornography use, because, you know, a lot of people will say, if you watch porn, you're a terrible person, you're going to go to hell, et cetera, et cetera. But also in terms of talking about sexual health, so talking about things like body image, dissatisfaction, gender-based violence, the fetishization of gay and transgender communities, and ultimately setting up unrealistic expectations for sex. And there was a study that came out in 1996, because obviously ethics have changed since 1996, where they actually showed sexually explicit material to these students. And what they did with one group is that they had pre and post debriefings. And with the other group, they just watched the sexually explicit material, and that was it. And what they found with the group that had the pre and post debriefings was that they knew it was not real because they had talked about it. And what's super interesting is that they had less rape supported beliefs. And so ultimately I say that talking about porn is super vital and incredibly important, because the average age of first access to porn in Canada is 11 years old. And when I was at Sex Down South, I was told that it was actually 10 years old in the United States. So it's actually younger in the United States.
Well, with the proliferation of the, technology as we have it, I would certainly, that certainly would seem to make sense. And that is one of the reasons why myself as a parent, I'm mindful of the screen time. And again, it's not so much because, oh my gosh, the world's going to end if somebody has access to it, but more about how do I have dialogues about, what is it that we're saying, what is it that we're saying on the screen? I want to shift gears just a little bit, getting to the personal component of it. From the standpoint of, I'll give you a quick story. When I was, what I've done for a long, long time has been real estate sales. I've been a realtor for a long, long time. And, but I was a manager for a company at a very early age. I just had the moxie and I had the personality and I made the right connections. And I was able to manage companies in my mid-20s. And one of the things that I encountered was that I was going into rooms, big rooms with 40, 50, 60-year-olds, people many years my junior, and I was the manager, so in effect, the boss, but not necessarily getting the respect, given respect, because of my youth. You are obviously extremely well-studied and obviously an attractive young person. when you go to these, when you go to, because I know that you have events and you go, you would also go to somebody, you know, you would, I think in, on your website, you talk about that you could have private events for folks where you coach. I think it's advertised on your website, private parties, where I'm assuming there's conversations about where you guide people to conversations. But how does somebody who's youthful, for lack of a better term, garner the respect, if that's the right term, from people that are older, perhaps a little bit more conservative, but how do you bridge that?
Yeah, I ultimately, as I've kind of said that, my presentations are more so about how to have these conversations as educators. I also work back home here at a sexual assault center, and I've spoken to pretty much all grades from grade one all the way through high school, college, university. I've spoken to doctors. I've spoken to Scouts Canada. I've spoken to various athletic teams, and obviously, like, my go-to group that I can have the greatest influence on is definitely, you know, roughly around like my age, where it's like, you know, late 30s, 20-year-olds, that kind of like just getting into the real world generation. And so, yeah, it's definitely a difficult path in terms of gaining that legitimacy from the older, more conservative populations that, you know, take one look at me with purple hair and go, heck no. But I approach these conversations with a level of professionalism that I think really sets me apart from a lot of folks. And with the wide variety of education that I do have, it definitely creates a challenge that I'm not taking the route of a therapist. And then that's why I'm actually going for my PhD instead. And so it's one of those things where, you know, if people are wanting to learn and wanting to educate themselves, then those are the people that I'm going to want to work with, not the people that are going to take one look at me and go, you don't know what you're talking about. And I'm just, my typical response is, well, I guess I don't, but when you want to pay me, let me know, kind of thing. So, you know, I've been told that, you know, that I wore this orange dress in Italy, and one of the women at the conference told me that people would objectify me, and ultimately I have no ability to control what people think of me. And, you know, I think that if I just continue to influence the people that I want to that want to work with me and that want to enhance their relationships and create more long lasting relationships, and then those are the people that I want to work with, not the people that, you know, I constantly have to prove wrong. And yeah, I get that in more conference like settings, I get those, I don't want to say more conservative types, but I do get a variety of thoughts around, oh, I'm going to a porn presentation, I'm coming here to rip this person apart. But I really start off by opening presentations with an acknowledgement of the harm that happens in this industry, and that people that do experience harm, and I'm in no way not acknowledging it. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but I'm bringing it into the space that if we don't talk about it, that harm will get worse, and that worse things will happen when we try to not talk about something, when we try to ban something. When prohibition happened, you know, the banning of alcohol, that only created these underground access and clubs, creating spirits that weren't necessarily up to code and standard as to what would be considered a good drink. But, you know, people started to realize that when we ban access to these things, people want to access it and they want it. Sure. So my route with it is, how do we have a conversation that's not necessarily about banning it, but educating ourselves to make more critical decisions and really reflect on what we're seeing in terms of porn? So yeah, kind of a long-winded answer.
That's all right. You know, that's the reason why I enjoy the podcast, is because oftentimes we live in a world of sound bites, and some of the questions and the discussions that we have here are complicated, and they require that kind of longer form response. Yeah. So my next question is, I'm looking for, again, now I'm looking at your Instagram creepily, and I see that you were at the North Carolina Sexual Health Conference, and also you were at the Sex Down South, Alicia, you know, Sex Down South Conference. I guess my question there is, so I am 41 years old. My wife is 41 years old too. You know, listening to one of your YouTube videos, you discussed at length something that, you know, to a certain degree I was aware of, you know, the fact that we had that romantic, crazy love in the very beginning. And then you go through the different stages of that. And I certainly can resonate. It's something that we're very aware of. I mean, we've been married 20 years now, and we've been together 20 plus years now. So my question, a couple of questions. Number one, what are some of the misconceptions about what these conferences are, at least the ones that you've attended? And number two, what is the impetus, you would say, to a couple who is in their 40s, who perhaps are looking now, are now starting to plan a life post children, you know, because my kids will be out of the house here within the next 10 years or so.
We
hope. My two questions. What are the misconceptions of the conferences? And second of all, like, how would you say, listen, Mr. and Mrs. 40-year-old folk, this is the reason why you may want to attend.
Yeah, so the misconceptions about a lot of the sexuality conferences is, you know, it's just a bunch of group orgies and people talking about sex and giving blowjobs. And, you know, sometimes that definitely does happen at some of the conferences that I've been to. And there are some conferences that are a little bit more geared toward those lived experiences and not so much the clinical and academic work. But the lived experiences one are a ton of fun. I know Sex Down South has a really great variety of different types of presentations. I know during my presentation, there was like an LGBTQ education one, and then me talking about porn, and then there was a vaginal and anal fisting demonstration going on at the same time. So yeah, I guess some of the misconceptions are not really a misconception in some cases, but really it's a really great environment to talk to other people and to get to know all the different types of products out there, get to know all the different types of educators that are out there doing this work. There were porn stars at some of the conferences I've been to that are doing activist work. Then at the same conference, there's international sexperts, and then there's clinicians, and then there's sociology researchers there doing all these different types of interviews and presentations. And so you really get a whole plethora of different kinds of fields that come into the world of sexuality, everything from social work to clinical work to teaching to porn stars to activism. Afrosexology was absolutely incredible. And so you really do get a whole mixture. And so North Carolina Sexual Health Conference, since you mentioned it, if something says sexual health, it's going to be kind of geared a little bit more towards the clinical work, the medical field, if you will. But even at the North Carolina Sexual Health Conference, it was an incredible toxic masculinity presentation by Cole Williams that was absolutely mind-blowing. And if you have a moment to check out Cole Williams, I 100% suggest that you do. He's absolutely incredible. So it really, you know, these types of sexuality conferences are what you make of it. And I've gone over to Italy and Poland, and I've spoken there. And those conferences were definitely a lot less about lived experiences and more about theory and research, which was really interesting because then here I come in talking about porn. And one thing I always try to do when I go to Europe is to bring up the Europe stats, because they like to think, oh, we don't do that. We don't look up that stuff. And when I was in Poland and I brought up the Polish stats, the second year American literature studies almost fell off their chairs, because it was just like, oh my gosh, this person. So it's always it's always a ton of fun. So in terms of older individuals looking to get connected in different ways and different stages of their lives, you know, your body is always changing. So first and foremost, I always recommend that you learn how to connect with your body in intimate ways and different ways that you can experience pleasure. You know, the same type of masturbation strategies that you use in your 20s may not be applicable applicable in your 30s and 40s and 50s and so on. Joan Price, she's a I guess researcher, clinician in terms of older bodies and intimate connections. So she's amazing to check out. But if you're wanting to reconnect, I first and foremost suggest that you start with yourself and start to figure out your body again, because your attention has been put on other people for so long, whether that's your kids, your pets, your significant other, your grandparent or your parents. And so I would suggest first and foremost taking time for yourself. And then looking for more, if you're looking for kind of sexy things to do with your partner, there's, what are they called? Like everything to do with sex show, taboo show, exotica, to go to more of those types of conventions, because that's a little bit less educational and a little bit more fun and explorative. So I would always recommend going in there with an open mind and just wanting to have fun and reconnect in those ways that you did in your youth, where you would giggle and, you know, hit each other with a little crop and tickle each other. And so start to kind of go back to that more youthful kind of passionate connection and start to talk about fantasies and not have these negative reactions to them, but try to figure out, you know, how to have some fun and incorporate those into your romantic and intimate lifestyles and take it as a fun exploration stage in your life. Yeah.
Not us. We were always sex is purely for procreation. I'm kidding that we didn't do that.
hey, you know what?
I'm Latina, for Pete's sakes. You know, we're all about passion. So that was the other thing I wanted to, I have a frame of thought, but, you know, and I kind of lost it. So I'm going to find my way back here. But yeah, one of the things that I wanted to ask, and again, you know, not without going into details, but you, for yourself, how do you merge what you do into your own, you know, to your private life? I mean, how does, or do you turn it off at the end of the day? Hello?
Hi, I'm sorry. Can you repeat the question? I kind of must have cut out there.
No,
sorry.
Not a problem. That happens sometimes. That's like the wonders of technology. So my question was, do you turn off the researcher part when you go home? Because you mentioned having a partner earlier on. Do you turn off the researcher, or do you say, you know, dear, you know, I have a lab to do at home and you're going to be my guinea pig? I mean, how do you differentiate what you do for study versus what you do at home?
Well, it's absolutely horrible dating a sex expert or relationship coach, because we spend more time researching about the sex than actually doing it. You know, we talk about it with our partners, like, these are the things that are really, really great. Oh, I'm tired. You know, what I do with my partner, you know, we have a lot of really fun conversations, and, you know, unfortunately, sometimes my work comes into the reality. My partner lost his dad about 3 years ago or so, and that's when I was studying victimology, and so learning about how to work with someone who's experiencing trauma and the kind of things that they need and don't need. You know, it sometimes forces its way into your life, and you've got to utilize it. And for my partner, it's kind of ruined his ability to watch porn, because he'll be scrolling through and he'll just be like, oh my God, look at all these white people. And he'll be like, wait, I need to focus and I need to masturbate, but I can't stop hearing, you know, Alicia's voice in the back of my head going, yeah, but look at the bodies, you know, the lack of diversity and da 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 da. And so we kind of have some, I know, it's terrible. We do have like some fun times, but we also kind of make it a fun tease. And he's a naturalist, and I have to say a nature naturalist, not a nudist naturalist. I have to differentiate that in my line of work. And so what I do and what we do is that, you know, he always likes being out in nature. So we have these camping trips, and so he'll plan, like, I know when we're going, but he'll kind of secretly choose where we're going. And I just kind of hop in the car, and it's like a fun mystery, like, ooh, where are you taking me? Kind of, you know, incorporating that fun, that anxiousness into the relationship in different ways. And we have fun with it, but, there's definitely times where we do need to where I do step away from that relationship coach life and just kind of go, okay, you know what? I just need to be with the relationship, but it sneaks its way in there from time to time.
Well, you know, on another note, teaching an old dog new tricks, me being the older dog, one of the things that I got a real kick out of this morning while I was prepping for this interview, was I pulled up what I think what among your first YouTube videos, no, one or two, the other, when I was introduced to Lilith, and we'll talk about her in a second, but this whole concept that I thought I understood, I really did try to understand the basic physiology for, mm-hmm. I don't know if that's the right word, but of, you know, everything that goes on down there. And then you said something along the lines of, yes, there's this tip for, again, lack of better term, and then but there's all of these things that come from it and that are, you know, that are part of the female anatomy that sometimes, you know, people forget about. But then you took out what I think it was a dildo and you started poking the head of it really hard. And my male brain said, ouch, that hurts, you know. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, fuck you, idiot. Sometimes you do that, especially when you've been drinking. What? No, you know, no wonder she recoils. And all of a sudden, and again, this is where I think it's important that we do have these dialogues, is because I thought, oh my gosh, I felt bad for those times when I was, you know, 19, 20, and we were figuring ourselves out. Because again, I've only been with one person my whole life. We were trying to figure ourselves out, and, mm-hmm. and I was fumbling through it. And now we've had a lot of practice since then, and I think that, you know, I've massaged my delivery, and she's taught me a lot about herself, and I taught her a lot about me. But my point is that I was really tickled, literally and figuratively, to get to have that video, and like, huh, okay, well now graphically I understand what the heck it is that I'm going on. So kudos to you on that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I made that you're talking about my clitoris video that I have on my YouTube. And I made that almost like a year and a half ago. And about, I'd say 5 months ago, it just started blowing up with views. Like, it's almost at 70,000 right now. And I have no idea why, but yeah, I was talking about the clitoris and legs.
For the record, I must have watched it about 50,000 times. So,
Okay. There it is.
No, I mean, I just thought it was a fantastic video. But again, going back to it, that's the fact that you have Lilith. And so can you talk a little bit about her I don't know what.
Yeah. Lilith is my vulva puppet. So I hear a lot of people say, oh, it wasn't until my 20s and 30s and 40s. So within the last 3 years that I learned the difference between a vagina and a vulva. So the vagina is what's on the inside of the anatomically female body, and the vulva is what's on the outside. So the vulva has the clitoral head, the clitoris shaft, the vaginal opening, urethral opening, anus opening, labia majora, labia minora, and Lilith is awesome. Lilith hasn't come with me internationally yet. I'm too scared to think of what the PCSA agents might think of her. But yeah, she's a gorgeous purple puppet. So you can actually behind it stick your hands in it, and you can make the labia lips move. It's funny. She'll talk to you sometimes if you're nice to her.
Well, now see, I'm even more intrigued.
Yeah. So it's such a great resource. And I was at a university doing a talk, and a fourth year business student came up to me and pointed at the little rose that's on there. And she goes, oh, that's your vagina. And I'm like, no, that's your pee hole. And so these conversations, anatomically speaking, about what a vulva looks like and what's the difference between a vulva and a vagina, just all comes down to our access to education. And I get asked too about what I think about Pornhub's sexual health education page that they have. And I go, well, I have yet to actually find it. And when you go on the Pornhub page, you have to scroll all the way down to the bottom. So once you happen to make it past all the suggested videos and brand new content, it's on a little tab at the very bottom, this page. And I think it's great that, you know, Pornhub is taking some initiative, but I think they need to make it more accessible on the front page. As soon as you click Pornhub, like, I think it should be right there beside all the ads. And yeah.
Is that underneath? I pulled it up real quick. Is that underneath the Discover? And it's like, I think the third one down, the Sexual Wellness Center.
Yeah, that's it. The Sexual Wellness. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, you kind of have to search for it a little bit. And it's yeah, I just wish that it was more accessible, because I think that there is some great resources on there for people that are curious about what everything is, but I just find it very interesting.
It is very interesting, and again, it's one of those things where I here in the U.S. and I don't know how much you follow U.S. politics, and you're probably better off if you don't, because we're a nightmare right about now. But here in the U.S., we have a lot of legislation going up, you know, state by state, but also at the federal level, where they're discussing women's health. And it's always glaring the fact that it is a group of primarily white men sitting, you know, in a very professorial type of room, asking questions of a bunch of people. But more often than not, they don't know what the fuck they're talking about. Mm-hmm. When it comes to the physiology of things. And again, you know, I am a college graduate. You know, I have been around for a long time. I've been married for a long time. And even I, after all this year, and somebody who's obviously interested in, I am learning new things every day. But I think that there's an arrested development kind of quality to the way that we teach sex here in the U.S., where we stop learning the actual mechanisms of the human body at the moment that we graduate high school. And unless you have an actual interest in it, you don't continue going until, you know, you don't continue learning until much later. Yeah. And so, and I think that's the reason why we have such bad policy in the U.S. because A, it is being made by men. And B, it's being by me, at least being by men that are not even educated on the concept.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's different in Europe or if that's different in Canada. You know, I don't know what's going on your side of the border.
Yeah. It's really what I teach about is just the access to education. Like, I learned about math all throughout high school. Like, I even took calculus, and I have yet to, you know, be like, I need to do calculus because I learned it in school, right? And what it comes down to is when we understand our bodies, when we understand our sexual health, and even going beyond that, topics like consent, boundaries, healthy relationships ultimately lay the foundation for how we learn about ourselves and the relationships that we create later in life, and being able to say, hey, someone touched me and it didn't feel good. I need to talk to someone. And that's what I even talk about with grade ones is, you know, how do we feel when we want to give someone a hug and they say no? And it's okay to feel a little bit sad, but you know, there are other reasons why people may not want to give hugs. And so we don't need to know about what each person has going on in their life, but sometimes it's okay to not want to hug, and let's practice saying that's okay. And so that's literally how I teach about consent with grade ones and boundaries and stuff, as you can tell by my voice change. Yeah, I have some words. So in Ontario, we have a new provincial leader of the province, and many people equate to him as Trump 2.0. So this Doug Ford is his name. If you ever heard about the crack cocaine mayor from
I know who Doug Ford is. Yes.
Yep. So Doug Ford was the dealer of it all, and now he's the leader of Ontario. So in 2015, by the Liberals, or equatable to the Democrats, they brought in a revamped sexual health or healthy living curriculum. And, you know, it wasn't as robust as many sexuality educators would have wanted, but it incorporated new topics like consent, like cyberbullying, cyberstalking, harassment, LGBTQ and gender identities, because the last curriculum that was created was in 1998. And in the 90s, it was all about body image, anorexia, bulimia, those kinds of things. So when Doug Ford came in, he went, we're going to take out this curriculum because we don't like it, and we'll think about it. So he went back to the 1998 curriculum. So a curriculum that many of the students weren't even alive for when it was created. And at the Sexual Assault Center, that's where we got an influx of teachers wanting presentations about consent, healthy relationships and boundaries and LGBTQ identities because the curriculum didn't talk about it. And so 2 weeks before the beginning of school, it was late August. We start school the day after Labor Day in Canada. Doug Ford was like, oh, the 2015 curriculum back. We just... LGBTQ and gender identities to grade 8 and not grade 6. And so we essentially had a bunch of teachers scrambling for a whole brand new curriculum being released 2 weeks before school. But we also have an entire cohort that won't know what happened last year in the review time because a grade 8 student won't will have a grade 7 education from a 1998 curriculum, but then the grade 8 curriculum is going to be 2015. So it's a little bit of a mess, but, you know, we're working through it and working hard.
Now, do you think that, and that's, you know, Canada, the United States, I mean, we're next to each other, and sometimes we seem like we're so vastly different, but do you think that it's the issue is more manageable because it's not a smaller country geographically, but a smaller country as far as population?
I think population wise, Canada is smaller, I believe. You know, I'm not really sure how to answer that one, to be honest with you. I think that there's a lot of people that are misinformed about a lot of basic things in terms of sexual health, and that, you know, we really do need an education system that just educates people on it. And with the 2015 curriculum, when it came out, we started to see an increase in people waiting longer times before their first sexually penetrative intercourse. And so we're starting to see the impacts of the 2015 curriculum, and I feel like there's definitely an influence between Canada and United States, 100%. But yeah, it's always disappointing in some cases.
So no, good rewinding the tape back a few years back when you I again, not knowing when you graduated high school, when you went to university or anything along those lines, but I'm going to assume that it was after I did it. I graduated high school in 1995. In the 90s were an interesting time, but when was the first inkling you got of my passion is, well, sex, for, you know, if we're going to be crude, but that you wanted to go into this as a study? Did that happen earlier on? Did that happen in university? When did that occur?
Yeah, so it would have been around grade 5 or grade 6 when I started to become really interested in why my body was changing and why no one was talking about it. And the sexual health education that I got wasn't answering any questions. And so I started to do a lot of research throughout grade 7 and grade 8. And I found myself being so interested in social motives, thoughts, beliefs around how we flirted with one another, and how relationships were formed. You know, what was it that, you know, this guy's body's doing when I'm grinding against him at the Boys and Girls Club dances? You know, what were all these feelings I was feeling? So it would have been around grade 7 and 8 when I started thinking about these things, definitely not using that language, but I was almost experiencing puberty, if you will, through a third person kind of lens. Like, I felt as if I was watching myself, and I found myself just being very intrigued as to why the social phenomenon around grinding, wearing women wearing thongs, and how women dance, and how men, you know, these social interaction patterns. I found it very intriguing. And, you know, for the duration of high school, I thought for my entire career that I was going to be going into kinesiology. I was an athlete. I did a lot of working out. I ran a marathon, part of a lot of school teams. I, you know, was really athletic, and I thought that's what I was doing. And the day before university applications were due, I was like, you know what? I'm going into psychology. And I hated the first year of psychology because it was so general. And I'm like, none of this stuff is interesting. And it, whoops, sorry, none of this stuff was interesting. And it wasn't until I took a second year psychology class and they started talking about our thoughts, feelings, motivations, and then specifically close to relationships where I was like, that's it. And so I came across, this is what started it all. I came across a TMZ article that was talking about the American Idol contestants living in the Playboy TV swing house. And I was looking at pictures and I was like, this isn't the Playboy house. Like, what is this swing show? And so I started watching episodes of Swing, and this would have been in my second year of university. And I became so interested in it. And the premise of Swing is that it takes a vanilla couple from the quote unquote real world, and they go inside of this swing mansion where there's a bunch of swingers. And so you get to kind of experience what the swinger life is like for a night. And, you know, some couples, it goes really well. Some couples, not so good. And it, that was the premise of the show. And so they had this sex therapist on there. And I asked her about, you know, what she does. And I didn't quite get it because a lot of what she was saying was from the United States. And I couldn't, you know, being second year university, I just couldn't quite figure it out. But the host of the TV show was Dr. Jessica O'Reilly at Sex with Dr. Jess.
Yep.
And it just so happened that the Everything to Do with Sex show was coming to Toronto a month later. So I went there. I started doing some research about Dr. Jess, and I watched two of her presentations, and I walked up to her and went, "Hi, Dr. Jess, my name is Alicia Fisher. I want to be you when I grow up. What can I do?" And she's like, "Here's my personal card. Send me an email." 3 weeks later, I'm at a sex club in Toronto with a bunch of naked people helping Dr. Jess facilitate a workshop on oral pleasures. So that was how it all got started for me. And ever since then, you know, really within the last year and a half, my personal career has taken off, and it's all thanks to Dr. Jess for, you know, being that resource. And she is such a great resource for any sexuality educator that's looking to get their content out there. Dr. Jess will put you on her blog. She'll promote you on social media. And so Dr. Jess was really my rock, and still is my rock. We were on the same plane to Sex Down South and North Carolina Sexual Health Conference. So it was just so funny that, you know, the two Canadians are on the same plane. So
I didn't realize she was Canadian.
She is.
Well, no one's perfect. So here's the thing. And what that's, I think that's very encouraging for you to say, because I think one of the, and this is an outsider's view, as much as of an outsider as I can be, that it's a small club or it's a small group, the sex positive community. Now, I've on Twitter, I think that it's a different story because it's an online media. But when it comes to real life, it tends to be a small group, and in small groups, there tends to be gatekeepers. And they're the arbiters of who gets promoted and who doesn't. And I've heard of Dr. O'Reilly, Jess O'Reilly, and so actually we follow each other on the Twitter machine. But I always thought, well, are these people actually approachable? Are these folks are they willing to take one into the flock and also help them out? Because like in anything, there's economies and you know, there's so much business to be around. So it's very encouraging to me to hear that. Yeah. Here you were, a young person who is obviously extremely motivated, and she didn't put a stop to that, but instead developed it or encouraged it and wanted you to keep going. And that tells me that it's not just, you know, we're talking about openness because it sells books. Not that I'm saying that's what you're saying, but it's openness because we actually believe in what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Dr. Jess is absolutely amazing for that. Dr. Marky Twist as well is really great for promoting people. And yeah, like connected me to so many incredible sexuality educators, and I'm super lucky. I don't know how many supers I said there to have been to have been connected with someone like Dr. Jess, who allowed me to grow and didn't go, well, figure it out, and you know, here's my card. Like, you know, like she was just, yeah, super. Yeah, I'm always very lucky to who I've come across in this field.
So how many people are excited when they hear, oh, Isla Fisher is going to come talk to us?
All of them. I've spoken to quite a few people, and now it's getting to the point in my career, and this is super exciting, that people are actually starting to recognize me. And when I was at the North Carolina Sexual Health Conference, this guy was staring at me, and I was kind of looking at him. And I'm like,
it wasn't me.
Yeah, let's just put it out there for the record. Yes. And so he's like, I know you from somewhere. And I'm just like, okay, well, like I've spoken in Pennsylvania. Were you there? And he's like, no. And so we're talking and I'm just like, well, I'm just trying to spitball some things. And I'm like, well, you know, I have a YouTube video that's randomly blown up. And he's like, oh my God, the clitoris one. And I'm like, oh, and I did the pretend penis thing, and he's like, yes, that's you. I knew, I recognized. And so, and then I'm having people be like, hey, I know you from Instagram. The guy that I posted pouring wax on that chick. That was a random, Instagram person that followed me and was at the Sex Down South conference, was like, I know you from Instagram. So it's really cool. And, the audiences are continuing to grow, and it's really hard for people in this field to promote themselves. And that's why I've actually chosen not to talk about a sexuality educator, but relationships, intimacy, and flirtation. Those words don't get shut down by Facebook. Now, actually, intimacy does. So that's why on Facebook, I call myself a relationship coach. They won't promote my page because I talked about intimacy on there. And I have a lot of other things too, but, so it's hard to find, people, because what we tend to think about is, oh, well, I'm not going to look for a sex coach. I'm going to look for a sex therapist. So, just kind of breaking down those barriers and educating people about the big world of sex. And so, my following is continuing to grow, and I'm super excited about that. And people are recognizing me, and it's a fun process.
Now, when you say following, let's say that you were looking around, you workshops and you go to conferences, and you might find yourself either speaking to a group of people or in a panel talking to a group of people. When you look to the audience, what is the makeup of that group?
It's really a variety, to be completely honest with you. Everyone from in their 70s, all through clinicians, educators, to young people. It's quite a mix in terms of the conferences that I go to. I went to North Carolina. I went to like a sex for older bodies and how to educate people on the world of sexuality. And this woman was, I can't think of her name right now, unfortunately, was all about, you know, talking to those older folks. And that person ended up coming to my session. So it's really a whole variety of people that come to my sessions. And it's Dr. Melanie Davis. There we go. I just came across her. The Lifespan Faith and Engagement that she does. So anyway, it's really a variety. And a lot of people leave my presentations with something new that they didn't know. And, you know, there are people that come to my presentations that are like, yep, I look for feminist porn. I look for ethical porn. And I was coming to see if you were going to suggest alternative people. And you did. And then there are people that come that don't really know the world of porn, or the, your brain on porn, I think it's called, which is like a horrible site. That's why they created Real Your Brain on Porn, which actually, you know, shows some less some less biased research in terms of porn, which is interesting. But it's really a variety of people that come to my conferences and my talks. So it's always exciting, that's for sure.
Now, when it comes to the Twitter machine, because that is the Wild West as far as I'm concerned, like, how do you navigate through it? Because I think one of the things that I have seen from you is that you're posting a lot of articles and whatnot. But what have been some of the, have you had any good dialogues other than obviously meeting me, which we can all agree is the best thing that's ever happened? But, you know,
100%.
Outside of that, like, what would you say is, have there been bad things about the Twitter thing? Have been there negative things about Twitter? How do you use it?
Yeah, so Twitter has actually been my least engaged social media. I'm actually finding that my Instagram is the one where I'm making a lot of connections to a variety of people, which is super interesting, actually. But Twitter is where I find more. Pretty much everyone is there. So whether you're actually a porn star and your account's not getting shut down every 2 days, that's where I'm finding more of those. And I find Twitter is a little bit more critical and will say things to you and not really care about your feelings.
Sure.
They will just be like, yep, this is how it is and you deserve to die. So, you know, there was one day I was inundated with 400 death threats because I spoke out about something. So Twitter is definitely that kind of medium. And for me, like, even when you go through my Twitter, like, I maybe have one or two likes, if that, on my posts. And, you know, I'm constantly posting on my Twitter. But yeah, I find it super interesting that Twitter just hasn't really created a lot of connections for me. It's really, you know, if I want to message someone and some researchers, like, I can find them on there. But Instagram is where I've really been finding a lot of people. The Bedpost Sex Show, Intellectual Erection, and Dr. Jess, Marky Twist, Sunny Megatron. And that's where I've actually kind of been finding, you know, for the people whose accounts haven't been shut down, the most of my clientele, if you will, and my conversations at colleges and universities.
Yeah, that's
which is super weird.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting, because I have actually had the opposite. But again, it's you know, we're going after different things. I am, you know, for the most part, I'm interested in political things, and I'm obviously in my cooking. So if you ever follow me on the Insta thing, you'll see a lot of the dishes that I make. But, you know, I'm you know, 40-year-old man who, you know, likes his photography and whatnot. You're, to a certain degree, yours is part of the business messaging component to it. But Twitter for me has been a conduit to have these conversations. The last several guests that I've had on this podcast have come from Twitter to Twitter generally in the Sex Talk Tuesday specifically, where every single Tuesday there's a topic and people discuss. And I don't know if I came across your profile there, but they host that, and it has been a real eye-opener to actually have back and forth to some people that I never in a million years would have had a conversation with, and now that I can. And so, but I think one of the biggest differences, obviously, between you and I is that I'm a man, you are a woman. And I think that to a certain degree, if you allow me to be differential here in for a second, is the fact that that women, I think, on Twitter lead a completely different life than men do, in the sense that the vitriol that sometimes gets put on women users is over the top. Whereas with men, I have posted a lot of, you know, I don't try to poke fun at people, controversial for controversial sake. But even from the standpoint, whenever I've said something that goes against what's popular opinion, I have never in my entire time have ever received a threat of any kind. And you just talk about, you know, getting hundreds of them, if not more than that. So that to me is I understand why you wouldn't want to gravitate towards it.
Yeah, and I my work at a sexual assault center, I'm the community engagement facilitator, so I do all the presentations, the social media, but I also run two other programs. I'm the coordinator for it. So Mending, Engaging Men in Ending Gender-Based Violence, and Young Men Leading Change, which is engaging a younger demographic that are racialized or newcomer immigrant young men. And the key to those sessions is to have men on, like, men talking to men. It's a totally different conversation. And there's one experience when I was talking to grade seven boys, and I had a male facilitator with me, and one of the grade seven boys asked me, you know, is there more than two genders? And I was like, you know, really, it's a spectrum. And I went into a kind of a talk about, you know, we don't just fit into one box or another. We're humans, we're all unique, and we all have different likes and dislikes, and it's not just one or the other. And he was kind of nodding, and then he turned to the male facilitator beside me and went, is there more than two genders? Wow. And my male facilitator said, absolutely. And the young boy turned to all his friends and was like, yeah, see. And so, you know, the male facilitator looked at me and kind of smiled. And it's just that it's a totally different learning experience. And, you know, I as like the only female identified person in that space, it's important to have at least kind of one person there, but I never try to be the focus of the conversation. I just will kind of add in little points for the male facilitator to kind of keep talking about, if you will. And so it's just a different kind of learning and different type of experience. You know, it's annoying when people who aren't like you are telling you what your life is. So if I'm gonna be like, okay, as a man, like, you know, you're more likely to perpetuate violence, you're more likely to drop out of school, to drink alcohol, substance abuse, blah 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 blah, like, you're gonna be like, yeah, shut up, like, hey, yeah, okay, whatever, you're just a crying woman, right? What do they call it, like the libtards and snowflakes and all the things, right? Or the feminazis and stuff. But if another male is literally facilitating and saying the exact same words, you know, people go like, yeah, it's really tough. And so I have a lot of talks that I facilitate with other men, to facilitate with other men, about the notions of, you know, what it means to be a man, and that, you know, not being able to cry is actually really harmful. And, you know, I'm sitting here preaching to the choir, but, you know, having conversations as a man to other men is really transformational. And we need to kind of change that narrative and make it known that, you know, we need to create a space where, and I'm not saying like a safe space, but just like a space where we can talk about these things. And that's what my Mending program and the Young Men Lean Change program is all about, is just creating that space to have that discussion and to ask those tough questions of, well, she was saying yes in the beginning, and then at the end she didn't seem too into it. You know, was that consent? Did I just rape her? And so those are the type of questions that come up, and it's really important that other men are answering those questions and engaging other men to not only be better leaders and better lovers, but ultimately to put a stop to the notion of gender-based violence, because we know with regards to all the genders, they are most victimized by other men. And so men-on-men violence is one of the top kinds of violence out there. So it's not just a conversation about women, it's also a conversation about men too. And it's really really important that we all get on the same page and, you know, have more fulfilling orgasms, not just if it's legal.
Most certainly. And I think that's where, and you tell me how you feel about this, but I think that's when one of the things that I struggle with Twitter, not so much in real life, but the concept of giving each other latitude. And what I mean by that there's people are, you know, if men were angels is the old adage, I think, by Thomas Jefferson, you know, we wouldn't need governments. But the fact is that we are not. And by men encompassing both, you know, encompassing humans altogether. But the fact is that we are, for instance, myself, I'll just, you know, go at it from the personal standpoint. I am raising both a son and a daughter. And, mm-hmm. my, you know, I grew up in a machismo type, you know, well, so, you know, a very patriarchal type of society. Latin people, Mexican people tend to be, you know, there's a lot of machismo that goes on there. And very much what you were saying about men have certain roles and they don't deviate from them. And anything outside of that makes you strange, gay is not a good thing. And so I suppress for the majority of my teenage years a lot of who I was, not even from the standpoint of sexuality, but just from the standpoint of feeling who I was, because if my father caught me crying, it was sure to turn into physical violence. That's just the way that he was. And so one of the things that I had to overcome when my wife and I started discussing having a family is my fear that I would repeat a cycle like that, that I would become not so much from the standpoint of machismo, but from the standpoint of the violence that came so easily to my father. I thought, well, it's in my genes. I don't want to do that. And what I'm finding now as I explore, you know, being a father in my mid-30s, now into my 40s, teaching a young man and also having a daughter, is the fact that you said safe space, and I know that is a dirty word, but the reality is that we do need these spaces where you are safe to have a conversation with your son, where you can let your guard down and cry. I have apologized to my son for impasses that I've made, where I've made mistakes because I'm human. Equally with my daughter is having these conversations about the fact that your quote-unquote bossiness is that's somebody else's problem. You're just trying to make your point known, but people are going to try to label that as, you know, a negative thing. But ultimately, you have to, you know, account for yourself. And so, you know, but all of those conversations that I'm having with my children, all these teaching that my wife and I are having with my children, because we do that together, also comes with a lot of introspection on my side and saying, hey, listen, when I was in my early 20s, I did a lot of stupid, fucked up things. I made a lot of mistakes. I was fumbling my way through my 20s and I didn't behave correctly in these instances. I was chauvinistic in other places. I was sexist in these spots and I've made mistakes. But now I'm going to work on myself to better them. And I that's where I'm my point about, and I know this is a long-winded saying about latitude, where we have a generation of young people who have made mistakes, and I'm hoping that we find a way societally to say, hey, listen, as long as you are actively making progress and apologizing, you know, genuinely for what you've done before, then you get a chance to make up for it. But I think one of the problems that we have with Twitter in other social media, but Twitter specifically, is the fact that you're branded the person that you were branded once upon a time, and you're there forever. Now, that's not to make an excuse for sexual assault or for rape or anything criminal. If you did a shitty thing like that, as far as I'm concerned, you need to pay for the crime that you committed. But for making mistakes as humans, we need to give ourselves latitude to realize, hey, it's part of the growing pains of being a person. Hello?
Oh, hi, there we go. Yep. Sorry, you need to give ourselves latitude too.
Well, just latitude ourselves to know that becoming human and becoming an ethical human is a process. It's not, you know, you don't get to be ethical at age 18. It's like it takes a long time to develop that.
Yeah. And I appreciate you telling your experience, and I'm sorry that that's happened to you. And unfortunately, when it comes down to sexual violence of childhood sexual abuse, the majority is young men that have experienced that. And it's a really tough thing to navigate. And this is why I genuinely believe that we need to be having these very basic non-sexual conversations about consent, boundaries, and healthy relationships. You know, like, what is a good friendship look like, right? And being able to talk to people. And when the word safe space definitely has been claimed by certain groups as like, ooh, it's gotta be a safe space. So I actually use the word accountable space in my workshops that we're all you know, accountable human beings, and we need to be respectful, open, but confidential about what's happening and, you know, experiences that people bring into the space. And yeah, it's definitely very, very important that we need to be having these conversations, especially as just young people in general. And I think that this notion of, you know, what a man ought to be really sets up some unrealistic and, quite frankly, unsafe expectations in terms of how men, quote unquote, are supposed to handle their emotions, are supposed to, you know, the way that they're supposed to handle their emotions is not cry and, you know, have a beer. And that's how you're supposed to deal with it. Man up. And so some really great resources that I can kind of lead you and your listeners towards is The Mask You Live In. That's a really great film that's available on YouTube. And then Tough Guise, Guise. That's done by Jason Katz. And Jason is an incredible speaker in terms of working with men on having these really, really tough conversations about leadership is what it is. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. Now, let's try to, you know, we've been at this a while and we could talk longer, but, you know, I have to put kids to bed because that's one of my responsibilities here that I look forward to every night. But, to end on a positive note, or actually maybe not a positive note, but what is it that you're doing with your cat? He doesn't look happy in the Instagram.
My cat?
Yeah, there's a cat on Instagram. Maybe it's not your cat, but there's a cat that looks unhappy on here.
Oh, no, Mo is a very, very happy cat. I don't think he was very happy wearing his little holiday outfit. He's a nudist, if you will. He likes to roam free and not be constricted by society's expectations of clothing. But Mo, his full name is Kebmo Akibbal Norwegian Forest Tabby, and he's quite content. He just like to chill out. So maybe I'll put some more positive images on my cat on Instagram. I don't know. Is that going to make my branding better? Is that what it is?
Well, people do love the cat stuff. And I will say, you know, unfortunately, we did have a sad passing this year with Grumpy Cat being gone. And I thought maybe that's what the angle that you were going for. And but now I realize that, no, he's just not a happy fashion person. He just wants to be free.
Yes, I'll post some more liberating photos of the Mo on my Instagram within the next couple of days.
We'll be looking forward to that. Alicia, is there anything else that you feel that I didn't get to ask or that you wanted to ask or that you wanted to let us know? And then second of all, and there will be show notes, and shame on you because you threw out a whole bunch of names. So I don't know that I can get everybody's links on the show notes, but I will try to put as many of them as possible online. But where can people find you on the internet?
Yeah, so I'm speaking internationally at conferences pretty much all around the world. And I also have my own radio show, and we're just in production for season 2, which is super exciting. If you're wanting to know more about where I'm traveling and what's coming up on my radio show, you can head on over to my website, inspireintimacy.com. So through there, you can get connected to all my social medias, whether that be the Instagram, the Twitter, the Facebook, and even the YouTube page. Be sure to follow and subscribe. I'm always posting my radio shows on there. And I have such a unique and diverse range of guests, everything from beatboxers to BDSM experts, which was just posted this past weekend. I have spirituality coaches, adult boutique owners, and for season 2, I have an incredible lighting director or specialist, I don't know what to call, production person who's done lighting for Justin Timberlake, Maroon 5. So I'm super pumped that he's coming on the show. And inspireintimacy.com is where you're going to find all that information.
Wonderful. Well, I don't know if you'll ever make it to where I live. It's a very small market called Los Angeles. But if you ever make it out this way, I'll be more than glad to check it out. Thank you so much for coming on. It has been a pleasure for me. It has gone by real fast, and it's gone fast because you're such an entertaining and lively and energetic voice. So I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. And I think that's one of the comments that I always get is that my presentations are always super engaging, and you end up leaving with a lot of really great information and applicable information to our connections, not only with ourselves, but with our partners as well.
Perfect. Peace. Thank you.
Bye. Awesome. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.